Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Today's program is all about the Astoria Column. And because the tribute is primarily my own, I am obliged to make a disclaimer that most of what you hear on today's program is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only, in all the veritable cosmos. I dedicate this program to the bedazzled visitor to the Column who asked, "Do you have anything to show the magnificence we are seeing?" People from all over the United States and the world visit the Astoria Column. The great majority are delighted and awed at the expansive beauty of ocean, rivers, valleys, and mountains from the top of Coxcomb Hill. From wherever they visit, they acclaim the view as among the most beautiful anywhere. "You can see the whole world from up here," a five-year-old girl once exclaimed. The Astoria Column celebrates its 90th birthday tomorrow, July 22nd, the date it was dedicated in 1926 as the greatest of Western monuments. The column was built in 1926 to mark the Euro-American discovery, and that's in quotes, of the Columbia River, to mark the end of the Oregon Trail, pioneered by Lewis and Clark, and to commemorate Astoria as the first American city in the West. The column was located on the crest of Coxcomb Hill because it is the highest point in Astoria, though nowhere near as tall as the coastal mountains that surround it on both sides of the river. During World War I, a 90-foot tall spruce tree on top of Coxcomb Hill was limbed, and a huge American flag was flown from it, which lasted until 1923, when lightning struck the metal flag cap at the crown and set the tree ablaze, a year after the Great Astoria Fire of 1922, which might have seemed a last straw. The next significant monument at Coxcomb's Peak was determinedly short-lived when the local clavern of the Ku Klux Klan purposely burnt a 35-foot-high cross, its infamous signature of hate politics, during a meeting held on the crest in 1925. The cylindrical shaft of the Astoria Column was rapidly molded and rebarred in 1926, a decade earlier than Conde McCullough built his famous bridges on the southern Oregon coast, 1936, and 40 years before construction was finished on the Astoria Megler Bridge in 1966. Which will be 50 years old next month. The column was financed by Great Northern Railroad and descendants of the city's namesake, John Jacob Astor, and was part of a series of monuments sponsored by the railroad that followed its rails from St. Paul, Minnesota to the Pacific Ocean. It was designed by Electus D. Litchfield and craftily illustrated by Attilio Pusterla. Even though he's Italian, I seem to pronounce him Finnish, who was considered the last master of sgraffito, a form of wet plaster paint and carving developed during the Renaissance. Litchfield modeled the column after one the Roman Emperor Trajan built in the Forum in 114 AD to celebrate his victory over Danube tribes, then known as Dacians, now as Bulgars. The wraparound scroll work by Pusterla follows the patterns of carvings on Trajan's column and illustrates in spirals to the viewing platform 110 feet up from the base in 22 distinct panels, the first half century of American exploration of the lower Columbia River and especially Astoria, from Captain Robert Gray's claim of discovery of the Columbia River in 1792, which he named after his ship, Columbia Rediviva, Columbus Reborn, through the terminus of the Lewis and Clark Expedition, 1805 to 1806, to founding of Astoria in 1811, to the first wagon trains blazing the Oregon Trail in the 1840s, and much later, a depiction of a steam locomotive when Astoria was linked to the rest of the United States by rail in 1898. Astoria Erectus, as the column might be inferred, is obviously Astoria's most noted and notable monument. It is 125 feet high, and the top viewing platform is reached by climbing a circular staircase of 164 steps. It is possible to see Mounts Rainier, Hood, and St. Helens from the top. The column at 800 feet above sea level is visible from 100 miles at sea. Though it was never a lighthouse, as many who visit seem to think it is or was, it has been a beacon for the city. A three-day ceremony started on July 20, 1926, with a Founders Day celebration, culminating on July 22nd with an official commissioning of the column, although the sgraffito was not finished until the following October. Nothing less than America's settlement of the West was the grand theme motif sponsored by the newly organized Columbia River Historical Expedition of 1926, which chartered two trains from St. Paul, Minnesota, home of Great Northern Railroad. A giant Spirit of the West parade through downtown Astoria on July 21st honored the few original Oregon pioneers still alive. As J.K. Franson wrote for Clatsop County Historical Society's Fall 1996 Cumtux, a group of notables larger than any ever before gathered on the Pacific coast, including historians and authors, leading figures in American businesses and railroading, newspapermen and students from two continents, all interested in retracing the steps of American explorers and pioneers. The World War I Doughboy Memorial was unveiled during this celebration. Built 4 years after the Great Astoria Fire that almost destroyed the city just before Christmas 1922, the column was a source of pride and renewed morale for Astoria after rebuilding from the fire's ruins. Yet from day one, its care has always been haphazard. The column has been exposed for 90 years to the intemperate marine weather that has made the Oregon Northwest coast notorious and the entrance to the Columbia River a graveyard of ships. Quickly, wind and rain wore a pusterless scroll. 10 years later, he refurbished his work, but later attempts to preserve the collage either failed or contributed to the corrosion. Botched efforts to preserve the deteriorating artwork damaged it even more until the shaft looked like a dark pudding slathered onto a muddy pole, the artwork virtually indecipherable. Finally, after years of complaints by citizens and powerful pressure from around Oregon, the city agreed to research the possibility of salvaging Pusterless Sgraffito in the early 1990s. Consultants from all over the world came and looked and offered theories, until finally, in the early summer of 1995, restoration started. It took 6 months, and an international team that included two Astorians, John Gutenberger and Roger McKay. The unveiling was spectacular. After the usual banal speeches that November day, the real show was when the gauzy shroud covering the column like a new painting was loosened and caressed by a fresh ocean wind, slithered down the regenerated shaft as tantalizingly as a burlesque queen shedding a gown. The incredible scroll of history coiling snake-like into the sky shone like a brand new tattoo after resembling a mud pole for decades. The Friends of the Astoria Column is a bifurcated group that was formed for the restoration and includes a few eminent Astorians as well as Portland elites. It has twice worked to restore the column to its former grandeur, most recently an intensive cosmetic facelift last year. But the Friends, whose acronym is sourly sounded as FOTAC, have had from the start a bigger agenda than merely restoration. Their grand scheme has been to redesign everything around the column, which would include a large information center, and to commercialize it far beyond the existing trinket shack, such as charging admission with an actual toll booth at the bottom of the hill, not to mention a possibility of installing a tram up to the column. FOTAC's plans for the column have been almost Athenian in concept and scale, perhaps the most ambitious, a disputed Parthenon structure dug into the prow of Coxcomb Hill, overlooking Young's Bay and the farther Pacific Ocean, which would be designed as an information center, complete with a replica of the column. There was bitter controversy when a small forest was cut to improve the view from Coxcomb Hill 20 years ago, which profited a local gypo logger whose ambition might be to clear-cut the entire city forest. And FOTAC was severely criticized for removing the famous cherry trees planted at the column in the 1970s as a memorial to Astoria's war dead because they interfered with camera angles for a video that was intended to attract tourism. The trees graced the top of Coxcomb Hill along a walkway to the newly refurbished Astoria column. Directly in reverse of the famous old fable, the city of Astoria commemorated George Washington's birthday by chopping down the cherry trees and lied about why. The city council voted the trees be cut down, claiming they were old and diseased, which tree experts denied. Many citizens were upset at the loss of the trees, which were donated to the city by the local American Legion in honor of Astoria's dead of the World Wars, Korea, and Vietnam. Council members attempted to quell local wrath by repeating their lies that the trees were just about ready to fall over, but they were countered by tree specialists who said that though the cold, wet climate of the Pacific Northwest was not the best for cherry trees, they were yet healthy trees in their prime and with care would have lived another half century or more. A classically contentious city council meeting occurred during that period, which featured a petition with more than 800 signatures protesting the planned revamping of the column Commons by FOTAC. A former member of the Friends broke with the group and said that contracts with the state of Oregon cited that to significantly alter a public monument needs state verification and public consensus, neither of which FOTAC nor the city of Astoria had done. That meeting was further heralded by a breach between two members of the council whose arguments characterized the larger debate over the fate of Coxcomb Hill. One pictured the radical redesign of the column as a real estate development plan with outside capital and the intent to redesign a public space for private purposes. He accused the city council of being so immersed in the project to urbanize Coxcomb Hill and the money behind it, that it ignored the public's clamor to be involved until it reached a crescendo that could no longer be disregarded. The council had, in effect, he said, acted in reverse of its obligations to its citizenry. A newly elected councilman who dissented said it was Astoria's obligation to meet the need of tourists. He owned a bar and grill he thought would profit from the deal, and that residents must yield to the interests of capital. He drew negative noises from the attendees when he mouthed the old red herring of always seeing the same 40 faces in opposition to commercializing Coxcomb Hill. FOTAC's footprint was intended to be heavy, a privatized takeover of a public space, and its head man, Gordon Schnitzer, wanted to rename the hill after his grandfather, a former junk man in Astoria and founder of a shipwrecking company in Portland, perhaps even rename the city Schnitzer-Storia. It might seem the grand scale plans for Coxcomb Hill have been popularly thwarted the past 20 years, although it is likely last year's facelift of the column has refueled some of the old ambitions among FOTAC gentry. And it might just be equally possible they have simply waited for the opposition to eventually evaporate. The impetuous gentrification that has tsunamied upon the Oregon coast has uprooted many Astoria residents who opposed redesigning the column area into a vacationer's elysium, perhaps shifting the balance in favor of what is derisively called the Schnitzer plan. The large influx of newer residents do not share the same sense of ancestral and spiritual attachments of longtime Astorians who have been priced out of town. Certainly among the newcomers are tourism zealots and parvenus. Astoria officials would be wise, however, to take seriously the critical concerns of residents who do not seem especially impressed with the lordly pretenses of big city business moguls whose disregard of adverse economic and environmental impacts on lower river communities is the source of considerable local resentment. Astorians realize tourism has replaced logging and fishing as the city's major industry. Visitors are welcome, but the Astoria Column belongs to Astoria. And a personal note. I worked at the Astoria Column for nearly a year in 1996 through the summer of 1997. I felt like a god on Olympus. The panorama of a river as wide as a lake below the hill, foaming into the ocean that resembled a fuzzy caterpillar 10 miles westward. Rivers and bays spilling into the Vena Cava of the Columbia River. Mountains on both river shores separated by a wide liquid gorge. Forests recovering from ages ago clear cuts. Farms in small river valleys tucked underneath the Coast Range. Saddle Mountain resembling a library lion barricading the south. And downtown Astoria bunched up at the bottom of a series of hills that climbed straight up from the river, old houses and churches scattered over the slopes like children's blocks. From the top of the column, the epic vista of land and water seemed like folds of a fan. I worked at the trinket shop. My job was a mix between docent and concessions clerk, essentially selling souvenirs of the column, such as buttons that say a person made it to the top, wine and whiskey glasses, tiny tinkly bells, silver spoons, postcards and t-shirts, and assorted junk, all embossed with the likenesses of the column. And I sold forests of balsa airplane gliders thrown from the top of the column, plus candy, crackers, colas, and soft drinks. The money was supposed to go toward expenses restoring the column and continued landscaping. I have no idea how many people have worked up at the column the past 90 years. Quite a few, I expect. A city employee and his family lived on the hill as caretakers of the column, and unpaid volunteers worked with me in the trinket shack, mostly in the summer. My hours were from when the column was open to the public just after sunrise and until it closed at sundown, except in summer when the caretaker shut the door after he got home for dinner. I ostensibly worked for FOTAC, the Friends of the Column, rather than the city, although the column is a public edifice. I started in the summer of 1996 and worked through most of the following summer until I got fired for suggesting an irked donor ask the mayor her question if the personalized bricks she and hundreds of others had paid for were to be placed at the column during her lifetime. When I started working at the column a year after its 1995 restoration, the sgraffito was still fresh as a new tattoo. I instantly became possessive of the column, as I used to be about fish boats I worked aboard, which became a source of irritation with the City Parks Department and my immediate boss, whom I deemed a misplaced vacuum cleaner salesman. I worked through the fall and winter that year in the column trinket shack, generally alone 2 or 3 days a week. In the spring, I paired up with another man and a couple of volunteer women who stayed in the shack selling trinkets while I circulated among the folks who visited the column. I was often aloft the column like an old main top sailor, once or twice or more a day. The inside of the concrete shaft is dim until the very top, which gleams with sunlight even on overcast days through several glass panels that form the dome. At the top, I usually told people what they were looking at. I wore a purple polo shirt that was monogrammed with the Astoria column, which identified me as a person who might be able to answer a few questions. I helped people up or down the spiral stairway who were intimidated by the column's height and methods of reaching the top or were infirm and hard-pressed to make the climb. I joked about my own acrophobia to pump them up with confidence and chastised whoever made fun of them, warning taunters they were opening themselves up for ridicule of their own phobias. I usually encountered people at a marvelous brass relief map made in the 1960s. It topped a concrete base at the front of the column and displayed a 360-degree panorama of the surrounding geography with a "You Are Here" arrow pointing at the mountain-dwarfed bump of Coxcomb Hill. It was the shiniest spot on the sculpted map, polished by thousands of fingers. Almost everyone seemed inclined to touch the place where they stood, same as people are unable to resist tracing their fingers through the names of war dead etched into the Vietnam wall. I talked with hundreds of people who visited the column. Often our gabs were free range, people dropping in and out of whatever we discussed. We talked about more than local history and geography. I leaped at every opportunity to discuss environmental issues, especially local concerns about the river and forests, the shocking decline of salmon and degradation of water and air quality, as well as anxieties about what is now known as climate change. People came from all over the USA and the world. The great majority were delighted and awed at the expansive beauty of ocean, rivers, valleys, and mountains, and acclaimed the view was among the most beautiful anywhere. One woman from the East Coast said the column was the most magnificent monument she had ever seen. These visitors and locals voiced comments of the plans to redesign the column's environment, which are more than ever pertinent to the continuing controversy as they reflect sentiments of people the project is presumed to benefit. Most people I talk with said the presumptive interpretive center would be unnecessary and redundant. The column is its own interpretation. But if it is to be built, it should be far less ostentatious than previous dreadful schemes. Rather, a solid northwest type of design, perhaps constructed with the purchased bricks, that does not compete with the column's grandeur. And instead of at the prow of the hill, the center would probably look much better at the site of the present park building, tucked away under already standing trees. The info trinket shack should be relocated, the people said, which is planned, to give column visitors a virtually unobstructed view from north, west, and south, a horseshoe-shaped walk along the crest of the hill that shows the topography and drainage of the lower Columbia Basin. Existing park lawn around the column should remain instead of being bricked over, though that might not be possible because of the amount of bricks sold. Most people accepted the idea of an inner courtyard around the column constructed of bricks, and also every area where there is presently concrete, including walkways around the hill. The most adamant opinion was that a parking lot should not be built below the hill. Visitors and locals alike overwhelmingly said they did not go up to the column to look at a parking lot. There are enough spaces already surrounding the column that if all were filled with cars and buses, the hilltop would be overcrowded. A parking lot in the meadow would displace the deer that people, especially children, like to see. These remarks are from 20 years ago, yet hardly differ from concurrent hopes and desires that reflect original intent of the column's designers. As John Gutenberger has written, when Electus Litchfield designed the Astoria Column, its picturesque landscape, the lower Columbia River, was already in place. There was no need to improve on that. Litchfield beautifully maintained the tension between architecture and nature. The column was never meant to compete with anything else. And that was John Gutenberger. For quite a long time, I had a recurring dream about the column. Bulldozers gather below the crest of Coxcomb Hill to tear up the meadow and scrape out a parking lot as a beginning assault on column serenity. Opponents to redevelopment stand in front of the machines and refuse to move. A line of police come at them with tear gas and clubs. The people retreat but return as soon as the cops withdraw. This happens several times, but after a while many protesters have been arrested. Many others are sick from exposure to tear gas or hurt by clubs. This is when several protesters leave the hill and go to city schools and call for children to oppose the bulldozers. Some teachers try to stop them, but the children load into cars and trucks, which speed off to the meadow. Just as the cops begin a final charge upon the remaining protesters, the first groups of children show up and immediately take up station in front of the bulldozers, whose idling motors are gearing up to start gnawing at the meadow. The children save the day. The police are unprepared and unsure what to do as hundreds more children offload from vehicles and run to join the others. The children hold hands and sing happy songs. They arrive at the meadow every morning for 3 days, most brought by parents or neighbors, though one principal authorizes school buses to convey his students. In the meantime, the city council is besieged by hundreds of citizens who demand they stop the redevelopment. The council finally caves in to their demands and publicly announces the Astoria Column will remain safe from the Schnitzer plan. I hope it's not just a dream. And now, Footprints by Carolyn Dunn. In previous centuries, our human footprint was small, and monuments to our intelligence and skill, such as the construction of buildings and plazas, were viewed as necessary assumptions of our presence. Our planet now has been dominated by human life and human activity. Our footprint is large. Posterity will look for signs of this time's collective energy and wisdom. In doing so, will it look for places where we have constructed yet more parking lots, more trinket shops, and more information booths, small or large? I do not think so. I believe it is already an inevitability that our children and their children will search the world to find the preserved islands of the natural world in which a possibility exists to have direct experience with it. These will be the places where human intervention is the quietest, where the human footprint is the most difficult to find. These places will be the revered monuments which our time has extended as a gift to the future. Saved from cars, noise, commerce, and ubiquitous interpretation, these islands of undisturbed nature will constitute our Parthenon. In the continued unimpeded experience of the natural world which Coxcomb Hill provides, we offer to posterity our finest gift, and one which may even represent our holy of holies, economic sacrifice. This gift is the inheritance of non-interference. The most effective way, at the beginning of the 21st century, to tell the story of the settling of the West is not to build buildings, play music, sell souvenirs, pave parking lots, and other interpretations, but to provide the opportunity for direct experience. If we want to say anything at all about the West, it should be this. Our ancestors were people who, in hardship and exhilaration, had direct experience of all we now see, hear, and feel from Coxcomb Hill. There lies the land, the wide sky, and all the mysteries of cloud, rain, river, and sea. The internet may give us infinite babble, endless information, and tireless opportunity for commerce into every part of our lives. But Coxcomb Hill, undisturbed, gives us our real direction as well as our real sustenance, which includes the phenomena of quietness and scope and the inherent possibilities, therefore, of experiencing perspective, humility, beauty, and joy. The Astoria Column gives pleasure to many, and all of us are pleased that the restoration was done intelligently. Clear-cutting was allowed on the site, and we have to make our peace with that, each in our own way. Let's leave our intervention at that. Most visitors to Coxcomb Hill, both local and from afar, visited for the view and for the total direct experience such a place offers us. The reason we ascend Coxcomb Hill, or any high place in the world, is to live for a moment in the presence of the total creation of which we are a small part, and thus to be aware, once again, of our relation to it. From this quiet, unimpeded experience, we gain the peace and the courage to descend, once again, into our individual and collective lives. And that was Footprints by Carolyn Dunn. She worked with words as both a poet and librarian. She died in 2012 of amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS, otherwise known as Lou Gehrig's disease. She wrote Footprints for the North Coast Times-Eagle in 2004. And this has been Michael McCusker. Happy birthday to the Astoria Column.